to please come up and lead us in a word of prayer. And I gather he's being called a bishop, so.
All right, where I come from, the way we start on this is so I want to pray, but I feel a stirring in my spirit, so we just sing a song. How about that? And it starts from one song and becomes five. And that's how the revival breaks out. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the men and women gathered here. We thank you for the heart to learn. We thank you for the heart for leadership, leadership that ultimately is meant to be used to see the mission of our Christ, our King, come to fruition. And so, Lord, we ask that you prepare all our hearts here to receive. And we also pray that you prepare your servant to be able to speak with clarity, to speak with conviction, and to impart in our lives. We ask that at the end of all of this, we would have cause to glorify your name. We ask this through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, I'm going to need a white board or newsprint, if it's possible to set that up, because I have something I want to share with you. But I want to begin this, you know, we have about an hour, I believe it is. Am I right? Who's our timekeeper? About an hour. So let's take 20 minutes or so just to answer questions that may have come out of the session we've just had together in the main auditorium that pertain to leadership development. And then I'm going to push that a little further and share some things to build on what we did together there. So any clarifications, questions that you may have been left wondering about that you'd like to voice, and we'll deal with those first, and then we'll come to what I want to share with you in this session. Yes, sir. Tell us your name, because I don't presume everyone here knows you. Where do you serve? Okay. Okay. Okay, I'm going to come to that, and I'll show you what those 7 years are about. That's why I need the newsprint. And so I'll show you what those 7 years are about. So hold on to your question. We'll come to it in a little while, and I'll explain it. Any other questions that we may have? Yes, sir, at the back. You're right, and this is a big issue for all of us. You know, we're so busy that we can hardly keep up with just managing our lives, let alone now curving out time to train up new leadership. But the very thing that is a problem can become a blessing, in that if we go about it the other way around and say, okay, I'm this busy, what do I need to let go of to be able to invest time in the people I'm mentoring and raising up as leaders, and then give them all that work and let them be the ones to do it. Because I kid you not, two things destroy leadership development in our context. Number one is we develop leaders who never graduate. They're never ready. You know, they need to learn a little more, and they need to do this, and they need to do those courses, and they must get a theological degree, and they're never ready until they're about, you know, 45 years or so, and then maybe we can lend them something to do. And it becomes a problem, because we hold on to ministries far too long. And then the other thing that stymies, you know, leadership development for us is we don't really trust that they can do what needs to be done. We're afraid they'll mess it up. But, you know, be honest with yourself. Your mistakes taught you more than your successes did. And when you raise up leaders, you've got to create room for them to make mistakes. Mistakes are not fatal, except maybe where they are never processed and you never debrief on them, and therefore they never grow. We often say that, you know, experience is the best teacher. No, that's not correct. evaluated experience is a best teacher. And it doesn't even have to be your experience as long as it's evaluated. And so that's what you've got to do with them. Create the time and then let them do all the extra that you need to let go of, because then you carve out ministry for them. The likelihood is that what they're doing, even if they make mistakes, those mistakes are not fatal. At the chapel, what we do is we talk about risk. And we have three levels of risk. There's risk that is, maybe unfortunate, maybe a little embarrassing, but life goes on, okay? That's low level. There's second risk that you feel pain and it hurts people, but there is forgiveness, okay? Then there is a third level of risk that shuts down the church. The mistakes they're making are at this low level here. It's okay. It's not going to shut us down. It doesn't really hurt, people per se. Some may be hurt, but it's more about embarrassment and it can be corrected and etc. And so give them room to make mistakes, because it's not at this level that they're making mistakes. Yeah. One question at the back there. Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's what the question is about. Okay. Now, one of the greatest gifts that the church can ever have is a gift of celibacy. The Protestant church has trashed that gift and does not realize the cost that it has paid. We pressure our young people to get married. We make fun of them if they're not married. We don't see celibacy as a gift. Some of my most effective young leaders are the single leaders. Now, I'm not talking even about the ones we're training. I'm talking on our pastoral staff. The leaders who don't have, are not married, they're very effective because they can literally live ministry 24/7 in a way that a married man cannot, or a married lady cannot. And the ones that don't have children, because we do have a number of, staff members who don't have any children by natural birth, we pressure them to adopt. And yet the gift of not having children and having to attend children is a gift that the church needs. We only accept people who get married and who have children. And we make fun of the ones who are not married yet, as though it's their choice necessarily. We don't see it as a gift. The Catholic Church does. And some of the ministers and missionaries that it sends out are single people. Now, it's not always a healthy thing, even in that tradition, but I wish that the Protestant church would embrace the gift of celibacy. Now, all we ask of our young ones when we send them out to other cultures to plant churches is 7 years. If they're going out at the age of 24, they'll be 32 by the time their 7 years is over. And when the 7 years is over, it's over. We don't require that of them a second time, unless they choose it as a life. But when the 7 years is over, it's over, and they can get married at that age. But they're still young, and it's not a crisis, okay? And, would you give 7 years of your life not to get married, to serve the Lord, and go plant a church in a difficult culture? Why not? One of the problems we have as a church today of Jesus Christ is we've lowered and lowered and lowered and lowered the bar. So low now that, we now just give us 1 hour a week. That's all we're asking for. And, you don't have to sacrifice anything. In fact, we'll feed you, we'll transport you, we'll even pay you to come for this thing, because we've lowered the bar to the place where there is no sacrifice anymore. And it's to our detriment. Raise the bar. It was so interesting. We sent 4 young people to London to go and plant a church there. And we asked these 3 things of them. We had people lining up to take up the opportunity because they wanted to serve the Lord. And if that's what it costs, I want to pay the price. I want to be able to do this for my God. They, They were ready to do it. Let's move on to another question. Yes, somebody else. Let's ask a lady. There was a lady who had her hand up. Okay. Okay. Sir, go ahead. Okay. My answer will be cryptic in that it's not a clear answer, and it is this. A young leader is always ready to serve. What you need to be wise about is what level of service you will give them. But they're always ready. And, you know, you don't give an 18-year-old, you know, a church of 1,000 people to lead. That will just break them. You're setting them up for failure when you do that. But you can give them a small group to lead, and they'll do quite fine there, and will have to express leadership. So it's a question of matching the opportunity and the development of the leader. But there's always enough opportunities that they can be progressing up in terms of their leadership ability and growing over the years. My challenge to us is to have a cutoff, because if you don't, they will forever be in the leadership development process and will never graduate. And yet, the truth be told, you grew for the leader you were when you were sent out with challenges that were bigger than you, demanding. They gave you sleepless nights, and they made you sweat. Those are the leadership challenges that grew you. The ones where you could do this half asleep, they didn't challenge you and they didn't grow you. And so somehow, in there, you've got to have that balance. In fact, my balance, my younger leaders used to accuse me that I throw people off the deep end and watch them sink or swim. Yeah, maybe that's my philosophy of leadership development. I think I'd like to nuance it a little and, you know, put it in better words. I want to give them sleepless nights. If a leader doesn't have sleepless nights, they're not growing. And so the question is, what big challenge have I put before you that is overwhelming you but doesn't burn you out? What makes you go down on your knees and say, Lord, please, please come through for me, because I don't know that I can do this? What's getting you to ask the right questions? Because those questions will stretch you. And if what you're doing doesn't do that for you, then you're under-challenged and you're not growing. Okay? Yes, sir. Yeah, I will mobilize you, because here's what, you know, you is true, maybe even here in South Africa. The gift and the wealth of your generation is money and is wisdom and is experience. Okay? But your generation is time poor. And oftentimes, very distracted, okay? And so, in a sense, the best way to mobilize you is to mobilize you to mentor those who are younger than you, give them some of your experience and share some of your wisdom, is to get you involved in funding the gaps that, you know, exist in any church, and is to have you be a dreamer who doesn't necessarily get the work done, but can mobilize the troops to get the work done. And we need that in the church, okay? But the gift of the young people is energy, and they have lots of time, and they don't know what to do with their time, and so they get into trouble, and they have a lot of daring and risk. They will do the things that you won't do, because they know, you know, I've got kids to look up after and bring up. They will do things with abandon. They will go to places that you'd never dream of going. And the beauty of the body of Christ is that when these two things come together, then the work gets done. one without the other doesn't quite do it. And so you're a very important part of the church because you give the wisdom and experience and leadership and resourcing, even though you're time poor. But they're time rich. And so they can do what you can't do if you will guide them and walk with them and mentor them and etc. So there is a place for you also. Let me just say this, guys, because I think this is true of South Africa as much as it is true for the rest of Africa. Africa will add the next billion to the world population. The 2015 population growth statistics of the continents of the world indicate that China and the Far East has plateaued. China is no longer growing numerically. It is still, but very, very slowly, and it's slowly grinding to a halt, okay? To the point where they've removed the one-child policy because now it's an aging population, they can't sustain welfare, and they're in trouble. This is China, okay? Asia is still growing, but India, which is the fastest growing of the Asian countries, is going to peak in another maybe about 20 years, and then it's going to start, you know, plateauing and then start going down. Okay, it's almost at the top of its crest, so to say. Latin America is still growing, but slowly. It's not growing as fast as Asia, but it is still growing. But it too will peak, you know, soon enough. The US and North America, Canada included, among the white population, if you've seen two recent studies, one is that, you know, the sperm count in men in the Western Hemisphere is alarmingly low. And they're not sure why that is the case. But the population among Caucasians in, you know, North America is no longer growing. What growth America is seeing is happening among the migrants, okay? Because they're still growing. And America is still growing net-net, but it's slowly, you know, coming to its own peak. Africa, especially sub-Saharan Africa, is booming with growth. The statistics of Africa generally, and this is true of Kenya, I don't know how true it is of South Africa, the statistics of Africa generally are that 72% of Africa is under the age of 28 years. And the population will double by 2050. The population of Africa will double by 2050. And it will double again by 2100. In the year 2100, four out of every 10 people on the continent will be African. Not on the continent, in the world, will be African. And so, guys, what this means for you here in South Africa, if this is true of South Africa, and I believe it must be true, what it means is, if you're not situated as a church bang in the middle of that growth, if you do not have a vibrant youth ministry reaching this generation behind us, if you are not significantly involved in children's work, if you are not, you know, investing your best, even the character of your church should be that the average age of your church is somewhere between 20 and 25. If that's not where you are, you really are on your way out. And unfortunately, this is often true of the church. It's led by old people, and the youth don't have a place. They don't have a place to minister, to be themselves. You know, they don't fit into the church. And we preach to old people, we're only interested in old people, and the church ages with the senior pastor, and eventually it leads to its demise. If you're going to be representative of the context that God has given you, then the church should be young by nature, because that's where Africa is. And your best ministries, there was a study done, I came across it about 15, 20 years ago, so it may be outdated now. But they asked a lot of missionaries around the world, you know, when did you ever first decide to become a missionary? Most of them said, the good majority of them, maybe 7 out of every 10 said, before the age of 10. In other words, guys, you want missionaries, they're in your Sunday school. But of course, when we have Mission Sunday and when we, you know, call for missionaries, we're doing it with the old people. Moving old people is very difficult. Don't even bother. You know, just go to the Sunday school and get your missionaries from there. It will take you 10 years to develop them, but that's where they are. They did another study in the U.S. asking the question of why is it that the conversion to Islam, and this was before Al-Qaeda and, you know, Syria happened, why is it that conversion into Islam among 30-year-olds and above seems to be more, you know, growing at a faster rate than conversion into Christianity? And basically the answer they got from the survey back is, Islam tells me exactly what I'm supposed to do, pray 5 times a day, face Mecca, you know, and I know where I am with God. If I've done all those things, it's a works religion, and so as long as I do those things, I know I'm fine with God. But Christianity, you have to figure out, you know, did I have my quiet time? Is my relationship with God going okay? You know, where is this? What do I need to ask? It's too complex. And the 30-year-olds and such said, I just want a simple religion. You know, make me a Catholic. Just, I go to church, I, you know, do what I need to do, have confession, then I can live my life the way I want, and next week I can sort of set everything right again, set the clock back, and etc. I just want a simple religion. The highest conversion rate into Christianity happens between the age of 4 years, and in the Western Hemisphere, it's 14 years. In Africa, I suggest to you, it's probably up to 20 years. Most people who are Christian got saved when they were somewhere between 4 years in Sunday school to about 20 years through high school and early, you know, university. The harvest is in that field, but we're busy harvesting among the 30-year-olds, and we see very little return among the 30-year-olds. And so just to come back to the question you ask about, you know, the age demographic you're in, work at driving it down, because there's a whole children and youth bulge that is working its way through the system. And the children of Africa have not yet been born. They are coming. And we're going to double the population of this continent, and we'll add the next billion to the world population. And so get serious with children's ministry. The way that we do it in our churches, of course, is we all know we need a senior pastor. Okay? You can't survive as a church without that. And we all think maybe a teen pastor, but if we can get a volunteer for a teen pastor, that's also good. Nobody's willing to pay a worship leader. You know, why would I pay a worship leader? I mean, after all, they just come and play for a few minutes on Sunday, and why would I pay for them? And so we give them bus fare to get them back home. Nobody's willing to pay for children's workers. We've got this thing upside down. The first, you know, position we should hire after the senior pastor should be children's workers, because that's the future of the church. And there's a whole youth and children bulge working its way through the demographics of this continent. Are we ready to harvest when they're in that 4 to 20 window? Or will we start, you know, trying to harvest them when they get to university? And by then, it's much, much harder to bring them to faith. So that's an aside. Yes, sir.
Sustainable growth and multiplication. So whether it's with leaders or small group leaders, how are you growing leaders but doing it in a sustainable way?
Yeah, we balance growth by growing as fast as we can through the leaders, in the sense that our best effort is put into leadership development, and then we send them out to grow. Now, one of the things we're doing as a church is a slow realization that the church and the models we have inherited of church have come from the Western Hemisphere. They're not going to work for Africa. You know, buildings like this, how many churches can afford a building like this? It's a blessing that this building exists, and it needs to serve the whole church of Jesus Christ. But when you go into the townships, this can't be their future. Somehow we need to develop models that fit the township and that work in the township. And what likely will happen in the township is that the congregations are smaller and they're self-sustaining in the sense of, you know, they're meeting in a small rented, you know, hall, or alternatively even meeting in homes where you have 10, 15, 20 people. That's going to work in our context. But when you're leading at that level, the level of leadership sophistication is much, much different than a place like here. Leading this sort of organization or organism is much more challenging and much more difficult than leading a congregation of 20 people. But the truth of the matter is, a sower, when they go out into the harvest field, don't go and plant one seed and then shelter it and, you know, give it shade and water it and check on it every day. No farmer is ever going to make a living that way. You scatter the seeds, and as many as germinate, you pray for rain, and they grow and you harvest. And in some senses, we're in a ministry of scattering seeds as widely as we can. And the churches were trying to plant. We say, you know, it used to be the old Jewish culture that if there were 10 men in a gathering, you know, a religious gathering in terms of villages and such, that became a synagogue. All they looked for was 10 men in the old Jewish customs, okay? And so we've just taken that and said, if there are 10 people who constitute themselves as a church, are reaching out in faith, are discipling those who are young believers, are, you know, going out and doing evangelism, and they gather regularly as a church of Jesus Christ, we recognize that as a church. Now, if you've grown up in a church like this where you have 1,000 people, anything under 900 is not really a church. It's just a small group gathering. That tends to work into your psyche. But when we think about the house church movement in China and the 50, maybe 80 million people that were discovered to be still Christian after China began to open its doors, we're astounded. But indigenously, within Chinese context, without the influence of the West, not being able to copy the models of the West, they gravitated towards a house church movement. I think that's the future of Africa. And somehow we have to facilitate that. And then the leadership demands are much, much less than, you know, the sort of leadership demand you need in a church like this, where the minister had better have a PhD in theology. Otherwise, you know, they're gonna get cut up every Sunday they stand up and try and preach. You don't need that. And so we're in the ministry of scattering. We're starting small groups and we're saying, establish yourself, root yourself. The growth is coming. It's just working its way through the Sunday school right now. Just be ready to harvest and to be a barn house when that comes. And, you know, it may be small now, but the growth is coming. Okay, one last question, and then we're going to move on to what I wanted to think, since the whiteboard is here. Yes, sir, at the back.
Perhaps an older generation or something. So younger leaders coming in and leading in a situation where they are older people, and in an African context is a, you know, honoring, respect. You know, how do you help people to navigate that?
That's a good question. And let me give you sort of an answer tongue in cheek, and say that, one, I'm not too worried about that, in the sense that I want to be a very welcoming place for young people, because that's who we are as a country. And I want that reflected in our congregation. So our congregation at Nairobi Chapel, the average age is probably about 25 or 26 years old. They're very young. And in that setting, the young leaders don't feel threatened because these are their age mates that they're ministering to. But the church we began with didn't begin there. And I had a lot of problems about the music, this volume. I now, you know, again, you know, just jokingly tell people, if it's too loud, then you're in the wrong place. You know, get used to it. We have the Anglican Church. They are more than willing to welcome you in, you know. And I've had some people who are very angry with me at that. But, you know, a lot of my age mates, because I'm in the 50s now, recognize that their most important contribution to the church is the stability, the growth, you know, the structures, and that's where they lend their capacity and the funding. And we ask them to mentor. And we're not going to sing your songs. We're going to sing the songs of this generation. We had our turn, and we sang our songs when we were younger. And we can sort of get together occasionally and have a good sing-along of the old hymns and etc. But on Sunday, that's not what we're going to sing. We're going to sing, you know, the music of this generation. Because if we don't reach them for Christ, then the church is lost. They say that the church is always just one generation away from death. And that's the next generation. If the next generation doesn't get the gospel, then the church doesn't have a future. And so let's invest there. We had our time. And I'm always having to give that apologia to, you know, to the older people, and they come and say, oh, you know, we really, should we sing more hymns? And I tell them, you know, our kids don't even know those hymns. They don't know how to sing them. Let's sing their songs. We can have our special moments. And we occasionally do have services where we have a good old hymn, sing along, and, you know, but that happens once every 4 months or something. And I am the greatest defender of the youth culture and the youth and the future of the church planted among the youth. And so I take the bullets for them and I shield them from, you know, the attacks that may come from my generation. Okay, shall we move on? Okay, let me just get myself running here. There we go. I want to talk about leadership development in its intended way at the Nairobi Chapel, okay? Let me suggest this to you. One of the reasons why we do not see young leaders coming and wanting to be a part of what we have birthed is because to them, they don't know how to decipher and figure out how the church works. What is the entry point into your church for somebody who is feeling called to ministry? I'm sitting in your congregation Sunday after Sunday, and I can't remember the last time I heard an invitation for those that God may be calling into missions. We don't make those invitations anymore. An invitation for those that God is calling into pastoral ministry. I haven't heard that here since I, you know, started attending. And if I'm feeling that, where is the door I should knock on? If they can't figure that out, they won't knock. And so you've got to have a big red door that nobody can miss, that is the opportunity for me to explore God's call on my life. And it's got to be so big that it's the one thing people see when they come to church on a Sunday. They can't miss it, either because you're talking about it a lot or because there's very easy next steps into that place. Okay? You've got to identify that door. Now, we do it through a leadership development program that we talk about from the pulpit regularly. And we display those who are already in process and are being developed. And we get them involved in the life of the church. And we invite people to join up if God has stirred your heart towards this. Now, not everybody who comes forward will eventually end up there. But we, you know, we constantly are talking about God's call. God is still in the business of calling people to leave their career, to give up their dreams, and to serve him through sacrifice as missionaries, as pastors, as counselors, as, you know, community workers, or whatever else. There's a big red painted door that nobody can miss, and you've got to set up that up in your church. Otherwise, they just never knock, and they go to the church down the road that seems to have an obvious door. One of the benefits of having our big red door is that people now know if God is calling you into ministry, go to the Nairobi Chapel. They develop leaders there because it's so obvious now and people have come to know about the development program. That's one of the big mistakes that we make when it comes to multiplying leaders. The second big mistake we make is, now that I do know that God is calling me and there's an opportunity, what is the leadership development process that you have in place for me? Let me give it another name, because I came across this name reading a book that was titled by this name. What is the leadership pipeline at your church? How does one go from being a nobody down here who has a stirring in his heart to being a somebody up here who is planting churches or going out as a missionary? What happens between entering this door and coming out at whatever level, you know, I get sent out? So many times that in between is a mystery that even the senior pastor himself does not quite know what happens. And if somebody does come forward, I don't know what to do with them. What am I supposed to do with them? How do I engage them? How do I grow them? I've never grown anyone. And if you don't have a clear leadership pipeline, then people just don't enter that big door. And so one of the things you have to set up is a clear leadership pipeline. Let me show you the leadership pipeline at the Nairobi Chapel. And again, this is us. This doesn't have to be the way you do it, you know. I like to say we cook it up as we go along. You know, we're always innovating. If something doesn't work, we find another way. One of our, you know, often said sayings is there's 9 ways to skin a cat. If way number 3 doesn't work, try number 4. Maybe that will work better. But we're always innovating because that's just where we are. This is our leadership pipeline. That's a big red door over there, okay, that you enter through. And for the first year that you come to be with us, you are an intern, okay? An intern is somebody who comes in, they don't know what their spiritual gifting is, they're not really well established in their faith, they have a stirring in their heart. We sit down with them and we interview them and we question and we query their journey of salvation. Half the time they don't really know their faith well, but they do love the Lord, they've just never been discipled, and et cetera, et cetera. And so in the first year of leadership development, we invest in the life of the individual that has come through that door. And we do everything we can to teach them the Christian disciplines, to set those disciplines in place so that they are praying regularly, they are fasting regularly, they are, you know, reading the scriptures through the scriptures on a regular basis, they're going out for evangelism. And the idea of that first year is immersion, immersion, immersion in missions, in evangelism, in outreach to primary schools, in outreach to high schools, in street evangelism, in, you know, ministry opportunities at the church, caring for, you know, people that they can care for. And we say that you want to lead at least 5 years above your own age. And so if you're 20 years, then we'll put you with the youth group. If you're 15 years, we'll put you with the children. And, you know, we just immerse them in ministry as much as we can. But the intention of the first year is to disciple them, mentor them, and establish them firmly, ground them deeply in their faith. And number 2 is to teach them how to be a good manager of me. If you can't manage yourself, you can't manage others. And so how do I use my time? How do I plan for things? How do I get to meetings on time? How do I set up, you know, events on time? How do I, you know, establish firm habits of, you know, spiritual disciplines? Those are the things we focus on in the first year, on top of immersing them in ministry. After 1 year of this, and we're sitting down with them on a regular basis and evaluating how they're doing. And so they get little evaluations by their peers. They get little evaluations by the person who supervises them. They get bigger evaluations by the person who runs a program. They get annual evaluations where we're talking about, look, you're really struggling in this area. Can we focus on it? Can we see that you're doing better in this? And we'll walk with them. We'll ride with them. When I talk about never minister alone, it's these guys that I'm talking about. Always have them around you. Let them see. Let them observe. Let them stay in your homes. My wife and I had the privilege of building our own home. And so we built a wing to our home that is just for interns, put double-decker beds there. They eat at the table with us. You know, we don't charge them a penny. We can house at least, you know, 2 or 3 at a go, and they come for a year. And that year, we try and do everything, even simple things like house cleaning, parenting, you know, shopping, cooking. So many of the young people we're taking in don't even know how to cook. Even the girls, nobody's taught them because they're living in the city. Nobody's ever invested in them in these simple daily disciplines that will make for marriage, and they just don't know. And so we live with them and we pour our lives into them. We pray together, we read scripture together, we're counseling, we're mentoring them. That's the first year, okay? Now I can see a lot of people smiling and nodding their heads. I'm not sure why that is the case. I must have said something. Well, maybe you're thinking you can get a good wife from Kenya. Yes, come to Kenya. We'll give you a good wife. We're teaching them to cook and we're, et cetera. Okay. So that's the first year. At the end of the first year, we graduate them into the second year. Now, when you go through the educational system, even here in South Africa, one of the good things about the educational system is you know where you are all the time. Okay. I'm in year 3, and I think it's in your 4th year you go for matrix, is it? where you do your high school level exams, and then you go into university. You always know where you are, and you always know where you need to go. That's what the leadership pipeline is about. And so at the end of the first year, we graduate them, and they become pastoral trainees. And we give them a different title so that they know that, you know, we've moved a step up, okay? And so they become pastoral trainees. And the pastoral traineeship is a two-year program. In the first of those 2 years, we now move from being a good manager of me to being a good manager of volunteers around me. And we give them ministry at that level, where they're planning things and they're running events and they're, you know, doing the gopher work and behind the scenes. They're the ones running around, making sure that everything is happening. I saw a lot of people wearing red badges and registering everyone, and etc. They do that work, okay? They clean the toilets, they make sure that there's TP when we have a conference going on, and they do so responsibly and with joy, with a good attitude, and etc. And, you know, we're trying to help them understand what it means to manage volunteers around them by leading from the front. Let me just say something there. As Africans growing up in the village, many of us probably were involved in shepherding something, okay? Goats, sheep, cows, whatever your community is involved in. If you watch African shepherds, where are they situated in proximity with their cows? The Maasai, for example, or maybe I think the Zulus like cows, eh? Isn't it? Where is a shepherd normally when he's with his cows? Okay, somebody call it out. Anybody know this? Normally at the back, okay? Africans lead from the back because we lead our herds from the back. And what does he use to lead his herd? A stick and what else? Projectile, you know, he'll throw stones when a cow is out of thingy hill. They're very good shots, or maybe a catapult. We lead from the back, okay? How does Jesus lead? From the front. My sheep know my voice and they follow me. And there are cultures where you see leaders from the front. In Israel, this is true. They'll go ahead of the sheep and they'll make noises and they'll, you know, call on the sheep. And the sheep follow because they know that voice and they know to follow. And a sheep who doesn't belong doesn't just follow the crowd. They will oftentimes listen for their own master's voice. Jesus leads from the front. And as leaders, what we need to do is learn to lead from the front. And so when you're talking about leading volunteers, you lead from the front. You don't lead from the back. And so you have to live the life yourself. One of the reasons why my wife and I chose to adopt and adopt generously is because we prayed that our church would become generous in adopting orphans. It was so interesting. Recently, somebody reported a conversation with one of the child welfare officers in a government office that registers adoptions, and the officer said something along this line. Why is it there are so many people coming to adopt children from Nairobi Chapel? And I thought, thank you, Lord. It's finally sinking in. It is not our nature as Africans to adopt. It's a foreign concept. You know, there was the extended family and uncles and aunties who are responsible long before a stranger comes along and takes a baby. And so in our country, we've struggled with trying to teach the average Kenyan that it's okay to adopt and it's a good thing, and in fact, it can even be a godly thing. And I think finally, after 10 years, the Nairobi Chapel is beginning to get it. And we probably have about, my prayer has always been, Lord, please, in my leadership of this church, allow that at least 100 adoptions took place. I think we're somewhere around 60 or so now. And so we're getting there slowly, but not quite. And that comment for me was a huge compliment to the Nairobi Chapel that, you know, many are coming forward to adopt children. So lead from the front, always. And teach those interns to lead from the front, or those pastoral trainees. And so that's the second year. Now, here's what we discovered. In the first year, the interns come in and they believe that what a pastor does a whole year long is pray and read the Bible and hear wonderful things from God and, you know, have these wonderful evangelistic opportunities and lead many people to Christ. Ha! If only they knew what we do, okay? we plan a lot, we're in meetings a lot, you know, always talking, we hardly ever read the Bible, you know, we're stressed out, etc., etc. And we decided we need to shield them from that reality for that first year. Otherwise, what we're going to make them is gophers, that they only run around and organize everything, and there's nothing invested in their life. And so in the first year, we're going to immerse them in ministry, and very little administration, very little behind the scenes. But in the second year, they have now come to realize that a thing done well needs to have been planned well. And so they're more willing now to learn. So what is the planning that takes place behind the scenes? So invite them in the second year into the back room so that they can see the planning that's going on and we can work alongside them. In the first year, they're in the front, they're going out on school missions, they're going out in evangelism, they're discipling, and they're doing a lot of hands-on ministry and not much administration. But the second year, they start doing a lot more administration and preparation. And we found they grow from here when they come in to here in that first year, character development. And then in the second year, they grow to here. And we began to feel 1 year of back office work is good. They're beginning to get the principles of critical parts and, you know, planning, good planning, strategic thinking, and et cetera, but they can't do that for 2 years. And so at the end of that second year, year one being the internship, year two being the first part of the pastoral traineeship, we send them out with a church plant and tell them, everything you've learned, now go and do. But here, you were the one who was learning under somebody. When you go out to plant a church, you'll be responsible for it. So for 2 years, you worked with children. Now go in your third year, and you will be the children's leader. Now, they're going to go and start a church, and there's 10 children, 15 children. It's low-level risk, so to say. It's not 1,000 children, okay? And we found that they grow from here to here in their first year, to there in their second year, and then to there in their third year. When they were sent out, given responsibilities that made them sweat, they really grew. And when they came back to us at the end of their third year, they had grown tremendously. In fact, we found anything we give them to do now that they used to do before, they're bored, because they can do that asleep. They were on the front line. They learned to think strategically, to organize, to, you know, lead people, etc., etc. So in the third year, they go out under a church planter to help that church planter plant their church. And the church planter is involved in the Sunday preaching, working with government to register, you know, negotiating with community. They're the ones who do the running around, and they deal with evangelism and discipleship and setting up small groups. They do all that in their third year. And so they come back to us, and now we're challenged to keep them growing, because now after the 2 years, okay, so this is 1 year, this is 2 years, okay, 2 years. And then they go into their fourth year, actually, and we call this, they become ministry trainees, okay? They were pastoral trainees there. Now they're ministry assistants, sorry, okay? They're ministry assistants. And this is a 1, maybe 2 year program. Because what we try and do for this year, the fourth year, is they come back to us, and now we make them responsible in a big church like the chapel to be at the front line, leading services, planning them, thinking through the budgets, running budgets, all those sorts of things. And then in that time period, we try and give them a global exchange opportunity. Send them to another culture, another country, where they're going to do some of what they're doing. And so we've sent people to Australia, to New Zealand, you know, to the US, to Europe, etc. And we look for partner churches and say, look, they only know their one culture. Can we send them to your culture? We have people in Liberia, in Malawi, in et cetera, et cetera. Anywhere we can send, where we're planting churches or where we have a church we can partner with and send somebody to for 6 months to a year, we send them, okay, for that. And so that becomes their 1 to 2 year process. Now, here's what we've discovered. When we send people to the Western Hemisphere, they turn soft. And so we're not sending them to the Western Hemisphere anymore, because they come back to us soft. They have cooled down in their passion. They have slowed down in their, you know, in their ministry commitments. And they've just gone soft. And part of it is the, you know, allure of living a Western type lifestyle. If you send them to America, the consumerism, just the culture of their age mates, the millennials there, they come back soft to us. And so we have now slowed down sending them to Europe and sending them to the West. We're now intentionally sending them to other parts of Africa or to the East. Send them to India, where they still send out martyrs. That will harden them. Okay? We want to send them to a really challenging situation, to the Middle East, where they can go and work with churches there and really be stretched, trying to witness in a Muslim setting. Okay? We want them to go to a boot camp. We call these boot camps. We want them to go to a boot camp that will harden them and make them more passionate, more prayerful, more committed and passionate about their spiritual disciplines and about, you know, walking in faith, and not to places where, you know, they come back soft to us. And so that's the third turn. The fourth turn is they come from there and they become a director with us. Okay, and this can be anything from a 2-year to a 4-year commitment. And then from there, they become an assistant pastor. Okay, and again, that can be 2 to 5 years. And then from there, they become a pastor in the church. And then from there, they become an associate pastor. And from there, they become the senior pastor. Okay, and this is our leadership pipeline. Now, if you look at it, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 8 levels of leadership. And in a big church like the chapel, you can see all the 8 levels. And there are people in the process of leadership development through those levels. We have markers for each of these levels. And I sent a copy of the markers that we have for the levels to Ross. And so if somebody could pass around a paper, and if you want a copy of that marker, he promised that he will send it by email to you, okay? And what are the markers we're looking for here? How do you succeed at level 1? Because, figure this, every time you change a level, 3 things change about leadership, going from one level to the other. And you can be a success in one level, but the markers for the next level are not more of the level you are in, because 3 things change. Number 1 thing that changes when you move from one level to another is the way you use your time changes. In level 1, you use your time best by managing yourself well. Okay? Being a good steward of your own personal capacity. Okay? But when you go to level 2, you use your time well by leading others. In other words, I can't spend all my time saying I'm too busy to have volunteers. You will succeed at level 2 because you gave some of your time to volunteers and you mentored and walked with them and taught them what needs to be done. In level 1, it was really about me and the way I use my time and getting to meetings on time and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in level 2, I now have to be generous with my time towards others. Second thing that happens when you move to level 2 is give me a minute here. I don't have my glasses. My print is too small. Okay. Second thing that changes when you get to level 2 is the values on how to get the job done change. In level 1, the values of how to get the job done was to be disciplined in my personal life. And personal discipline is an important value at an intern level. But in level 2, I succeed through others. And so an important value becomes that it's not just about, you know, my personal discipline. It is that I must encourage and motivate others. And my value shifts from myself to that level. And as you go up the leadership pipeline, every time you turn a corner, the way you use your time changes and the values that drive that level of leadership changes. The third thing that changes is the skills you need. Level 1, the level of skills I need is low. It's really about personal management. Level 2, I have to pick up a whole new set of skills in how to motivate others, how to cast vision, and those sorts of things. Now, you can be a success at one level and be a failure at the next level unless you turn the corner and you recognize what changes. And the document that Ross is supposed to send will have some of those things and what changes as you go through each level. Second thing about going through the levels is this, okay? Sometimes a leader is parked over here. This is you, okay? This is you. You're parked over here, you're a pastor. And you have become a block in the pipeline, okay? And when you see this young leader, you know, sort of approaching you, you begin to sit on them and to kill their leadership because you're afraid of being unseated. Okay? That's African. Yes, it is. Look at our presidents. Eh? They're all like this. Okay. And so one of the things, for me as a senior pastor here, one of the things I'm always looking for is blocks and necessary conversations with that person to say, look, you need to be growing to the next level. If you remain here and you become a block, then I need to remove you because it means nothing will flourish under you. And when a young leader is over here and they can see there's a blockage there, do you know what they do? Somebody said it. What do? They leave. Yeah. Because they can see there's no future here. This guy is blocking the pipeline. I may as well go to another place and find another ministry. And they leave. And if the pipeline is not flowing, you're the one who will pay the price. And so I've got to keep the pipeline flowing. And I myself have to flow. In December of this year, I'm actually stepping out of the leadership, okay, in terms of being the senior pastor. Because I've been there now for 28 years, and I, you know, will become a block in my own way unless I can step out. And I'm giving the young man that I have trained for 7 years, who is now my associate pastor, I'm giving him the leadership. And is he fully trained? Probably not. But he's trained enough. I've got to leave room for him to make mistakes because that will grow him. I can be on the wing and mentor him as I need to, but I need to move to whatever the next level is. And we have just created a new level here that is now overseer because we have 150 churches. And so my work will become mentoring the pastors of these churches and not leading one single congregation. Somebody else will take that from me. And there will come a time when the next person is ready to move up to that level and I'll need to move on and maybe become a sage who really isn't on church pay and really spends time just praying over, blessing, encouraging, and etc. Because if there's a block, your leaders will leave. Yes. Somewhere between, I'll tell you what happens. To work your way, say, up to assistant pastor, director, is something like a 5-year process. Okay? But what we do is, because you can't have 20 assistant pastors, you know, you don't need that many. At this level, okay, and at this level, we have an out. And the out is, if the space is getting too crowded, you go out and plant a church. And so church planting takes place at these three levels. At the end of your ministry assistantship, at the end of your directorship, at the end of your assistant pastorship. We try and graduate the bulk of our people to go out and plant a church. And the reason why this year we're trying to plant, I think it's 40 churches. The reason we can do that is because we've got a lot of people in the pipeline and they can't all become senior pastors. And so you have to have an outlet, and the outlet is church planting, and therefore you can raise many church planters. Yes. Yes. From year one to year two, we ask that 75% will graduate. And if 75% aren't coming into year two, then we question the intake at this point. We're taking in people who should not have been in the process. And, you know, somebody once told me this, and I think it's true. There's nothing great about Harvard University. I don't know whether we have any Harvard University graduates here, okay? The extension courses, anyone? There's nothing great about Harvard University. All Harvard does is it takes the best and therefore graduates the best. If the best are coming in through the front door, they're already the best. They're going to graduate out of the back door. Even if you don't do much with them, they'll graduate out of the back door, you know, as the best, because they were the best anyway. And so we just need to be careful about the sorts of people we're taking in. And we're asking for very high quality caliber people. But because of the context we're in, I kid you not, guys, for the intake, we get at least 100 people interested in coming in, and we can only take 40. And that's Africa for you. I really believe that that's true of our context, that many, many people want to serve the Lord. They just don't know where the front door is. And so you get people from other churches, university, etc., etc. God is calling them. They can't all come to the chapel. Let me ask. Go ahead, and then you come next. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, we have a second door there. Okay? We do find people who have been a youth pastor for 5 years who say, look, I'm stuck where I am, and I'm going nowhere where I am. Can I join you? Because I can see with you guys, I will be able to go and plant a church, and I want to plant a church. And then we recognize they are already past this level. Now, here's a problem, guys. When you take somebody from here, okay, and promote them to here, something bad happens. And the bad thing that happens is they don't have the learnings, the necessary leadership learnings that would have come by working their way through this. They have gaps in their leadership development. And if you over-promote a person, then it will show up here and you have set them up for failure because they're not ready for that level of leadership. Unless there's a coach who will mentor them and walk with them to help them with the learnings they missed. And so that's one bad thing that happens. There's a second bad thing that happens is that they don't have the DNA of, you know, the church or the organization or whatever it is. And the culture of work, why do we do what we do? They don't have that because they came in and they were promoted at too high a level. And they never learned those things. And so they challenge the system, and not always in a good way. They sometimes challenge it in a negative way because they have come with their own culture and they don't have your DNA. Now, there's another side to that coin, and let me just point it out. You have to be careful of you know, having ingrown recession with this process. If the only people who survive in your system are the people who have worked through the system, then they all begin to think alike, behave alike, act alike, etc. And that's a good thing to a point. You do need to bring in new gene pools into the system. Otherwise, you will eventually start having ingrowth gene pools that eventually lead to your demise. And so we do sometimes bring in people at different levels, you know, here. But 85% of those in the system have come through the system. And then maybe about 15% came from outside, and we promoted them because we needed their gene pool and we needed what they bring that we don't have and can't see that we don't have it. So let me ask you a question. If somebody is not from this process and they're coming in, who makes a decision? There's a team up here that makes those decisions. And oftentimes they'll come in at the level of, you know, a children's worker, a youth worker, et cetera, not at this top level. Though occasionally we have had one or two people join us at this top level because we felt they will bring a refreshing perspective that will help us. Yeah. Okay. Wow, there are a lot of hands. Okay. Yeah, let me take questions because the questions are on point. Whereas if I continue with more material, maybe it's not where you are and it's not what you want, okay? You can talk at home. You're from Kenya. Let me give somebody else. These two brothers in the green shirt and the black T-shirt. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. A lot of it, that's a question you wanted to ask, a lot of it is apprenticeship. Get them to ask the right questions, and then you're developing them, okay? So we are content-based, but we're careful about how much content. Here's what you learn about Africa in general. Most people on this continent are field-dependent in their learning. In other words, they learn best when they're sitting in a circle and talking to one another. And they think best when they're talking, okay? This learning that is field-independent that has come from the West is very, you know, how do I put it? It's true of the West. Many from the Western Hemisphere are field-independent. They learn from books, they learn from, you know, the web, and they learn alone. They don't need that processing time. But because so many of our people come from an oral culture, it is that the value is in the talking and the, you know, challenging one another and thingy, which is why we have moved away from web-based material, because that's just not who we are as Africans. And we want to process things together and sit down and talk about it, you know, where you have a healthy discussion with a facilitator who can keep leading you forward. But it has to happen face-to-face and, you know, et cetera. And so there is reading that they have to be in, but a lot of the time that we process things has to be processed in a group setting where we sit and talk about the things that we're learning. Or if we read, we have to sit down and talk about what we're reading and challenge some of it. There's a lot of leadership principles that come from the West that we assume apply internationally. Some of you have read Jim Collins. Is that his name? You know, Good to Great and et cetera, et cetera. Half the things he says there are really contextual and cultural. They're not necessarily, you know, global. But the presumption is that because the West is so rich, that anything they do in leadership should be the way the rest of the world does it. Well, the Chinese don't do it that way, and they're doing phenomenally well in their economies and et cetera. But we have to challenge, you know, what is appropriate for us contextually here. And we have moved in the direction of, even in our theology learning, to, you know, field-dependent learning as opposed to field-independent learning. Okay? You had a question behind him. Now, the material that will be passed on to you has some of that and some of the things that we study together. Yes? This came as a result of what I was talking about in the morning session, okay? And as I said a little earlier, we make it up as we go along. This is in process, and it's not complete, and it's not refined. We're always changing things about this. We're always trying to learn from the quality of leaders we're seeing coming out through this process. There's a lot of mistakes we've made. There's a lot of mistakes we haven't yet made, and we're going to make them sooner or later. But we keep moving forward and trying to refine the system. Amazingly, more and more churches in our context are beginning to see the value of this. One of the big questions that people say is, but how can you afford to have 40 interns? You know, who's paying all that money? We don't. Because the other thing we're trying to do is develop models in Africa that are not cash dependent. That, again, is something that has come out of a Western model of missions that is, you know, coming out of a strong economy with a lot of disposable income, and, you know, they're able to do amazing things in terms of architecture and material and et cetera. That's not for us in Africa. And so we're always asking the question of how can we do this without making money the center of everything? And if your leadership process is dependent on money and you don't have money, then you're not going anywhere until you figure out how to get it done without money. And so we've figured our ways to get it done without money. You know, maybe like Laban, will promise you a wife in 7 years if you work for us, you know? That was a cashless economy. But we're always trying to, you know, ask a question. Is it sustainable? Can we afford it? What do we do? There's got to be a way. When God gave us a great commission, he did not say, only go if you have money. There's got to be a way how this can be done. And indeed, we have found ways to get it done. Okay? Then somebody had a question here. Have you asked a question before? I think you have. So let's give somebody else an opportunity. When When we train our pastors, we tell them there are 10 places you can get the resources you need. Okay, and I won't go through that, but one of the places that these guys apply is everyone is coming in with a web of networks. Okay, those networks are a resource. Okay, so you can go to uncles and aunties and tell them, God is calling you, would you support me? It's just a little, and they can chip in. We challenge them for every shilling, our currency is shilling, every shilling they bring in, we will give them a shilling up to a ceiling. It's a low ceiling because they're young, they're 20-year-olds, they're not renting a house, they can rent together, live together, and in a small flat of 2 bedrooms, you can have at least 6 people live there, and so they can keep the costs down. We ask our members to support them. We ask our members to finance some of that, and we ask our members to house them. And so we talk about the 10 different ways that you can find the resources you need for this. So they have to look for some of it, and we help with some of it. And we try as much as possible not to make the bottleneck money, 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 but to find ways around that. And that's why we have so many. Yeah. Okay. One last question, and then I think we're out of time. Let's give the lady. Yes. You said your name is Dana? Okay. I don't know that I want to answer your question. Can we have another question from... Okay, let me try, Dana. Again, I won't give you a complete answer because it would take too long to do this. But you raise a question of what is the appropriate level of ministry for a lady? Okay? And I would recouch your question a different way and say that the big question that the church has wrestled with is not women in ministry, but women in leadership. There's a difference between those two. There's no question about women in ministry. And there are ample opportunities for women in ministry here. The question is, what about women in leadership? It's this that you're asking about, or it's this that the church wrestles with. Can a woman be the senior pastor? Can a woman be the elder? Can a woman be an overseer? Okay? Otherwise, this we have no argument about. Okay? And in fact, even churches that say this is not possible have women leading in many, many different places. Children's ministry, involved with counseling, etc., etc. So it's not women in ministry that's a question. It's women in leadership. And then that introduces a second question as to what is leadership and where does leadership reside? Does it reside in the senior pastor? Does it reside in the elders' board? Does it reside in the bishopric or an overseer or whatever level? Okay? And if it resides, let's say, in our culture, okay, at the Nairobi Chapel, we come from a Plymouth Brethren background. That was the roots if you go back into the pre-independence days. It was Plymouth Brethren. And leadership resides in the eldership. Okay? And I am one of the elders by the fact of my position, a teaching elder. Okay? So I serve as an elder too. And therefore, the way the Plymouth Brethren would say it is that women cannot be elders in the church because that's where leadership resides. But any of these other positions they can be because all other positions subsume under the authority here. So they can be an assistant pastor, they can be an associate pastor, they can be a pastor, they can be an assistant pastor, they can be all this. So they can be pastors, but they can't be elders, and therefore they cannot be the senior elder. Now, to be honest with you, we've just reviewed that as of, I think, just 6 months ago, where we said we actually want to review that position, and we now do have women who are pastors. That's a big question, a big debate. We could go into that. It took us 2 years of studying together the issue to finally come to a position on it. Yeah. That's why I didn't want to answer your question. Okay. I think we're out of time, if I'm not wrong. And the bishop, probably
All right. Okay, hold on, hold on. Can we? Hello, hello, hello. The bishop is talking. Can we please appreciate Pastor Oscar? Please. Thank you very much. What a lot of us don't know is actually he'd spent some time in the States, and he just basically came back from the States, dropped his bag in the States, and then actually came in Kenya, went back to Kenya, dropped his bag in Kenya, and came over here. So he's been the amount of sacrifice and the time he's poured into us. I'm sure all of us are wishing we could keep him for just even another day, right? Isn't it? All right, we'll extend another invitation for the next conference. All right. Thank you. All right, so what's going to happen now is there's going to be tea and some refreshment, and the real bishop, the bishop of BBC and Johannesburg, is actually going to speak. You don't want to miss Ross. For some of us that have listened to Ross speak, you don't want to miss that. So that, you should be seated in by 3:25, so you've got about 20 minutes. So at 3:25, let's be seated in there, and then we kick off. All right.